The World Affairs Council in San Francisco, February 18, 2010.
It's now my honor to introduce our guests this evening. Mr. Stephen Hill is a political writer and director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation, which seeks to develop the best opportunities for reform, educate opinion leaders, and the public about electoral alternatives. Mr. Hill's articles and commentaries have appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, International Herald Tribune, as well as the UK's The Guardian. France's Le Monde Diplomatique and Turkey's Hurriyet Daily News. He has also appeared on national and local radio and television programs and has lectured widely in the United States and Europe. So here to offer us an insight into Europe's vision for how a modern society should provide economic security, environmental sustainability, as well as global stability. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you'll join me in welcoming Stephen Hill.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm actually from San Francisco, so I haven't traveled very far, but I've been all around the country giving talks on this, and I guess we've got people on every side here. I have to keep track of that. There couldn't be a better time, really, to have this discussion, I think. Just over a year ago that we had an economic collapse of historic dimensions. You see headlines now about what's going on in Greece. What's that about? You know, the deficit problems that they're having in some of the European countries. But, of course, we know something about that here in California, right, where we've issued IOUs. The initial shock of the economic collapse, we're seeing lots of aftershocks around the world, in Europe, in the United States and others, and we're going to see those for some time to come, I believe. And so it really is a good time to start really thinking about, is there a way we can do this better in the United States? That really is what the point of the book, of my book, Europe's Promise, is can we learn from Europe and other places as well to do things differently that might lead to a different outcome than what we've experienced over the last year and a half. So Europe's Promise is a story about post-World War II Europe and how it transformed itself from a military warring powers. The nations there had been military warring powers for centuries, right? And how they transformed themselves from that into a model for how a modern society can develop itself, can take care of its people, can foster what I call in the book peace and prosperity partnerships with its neighbors, and do all that in a way that's as environmentally sustainable as possible. The book has two basic premises that are important to understand. The first is that one of the great challenges of the 21st century is for the world to figure out how do we identify the institutions and practices that are going to allow a burgeoning population in the world of 6.5 billion people to enjoy a decent quality of life. Or, in other words, how do we allow the Chinas, the Indias, the Brazils of the world to rise up and enjoy what we in the United States and Europe and Japan and other places have enjoyed without burning up the planet in the process, because of the process of development, which creates so much carbon emissions, so much pollution, and other results of development. If you don't agree with those two premises of the book might be rather boring for you. But if you do agree that those two premises are, in some ways, the challenge of the 21st century, then what I've found is that Europe actually has a lot of innovations going on that directly address these two challenges of the 21st century. And it's a pretty tall order to fill that we have in front of us. I've looked at Europe in five different ways, and I'm just going to briefly summarize them, and I'll fill out some of them during my talk, and then to whatever you're interested in, we can explore it more deeply into questions and answers. Five areas. One is in terms of the economy. Europe has employed some very unique institutions to create a very vibrant, robust economy, contrary to many of the stereotypes we've heard about Europe. And they've also introduced some elements of economic democracy that I find quite exciting. Secondly, in the areas of health care and supports for families and individuals, which is increasingly important in this area of economic insecurity. Third, in the area of energy and transportation, particularly in implementing some technologies having to do with renewable technologies, conservation technologies, and again, and that's an area that's increasingly important in this 21st century, in this era of global warming. Fourth, in the area of political democracy, when you look at how President Barack Obama is having difficulties passing anything in a filibuster-gone wild Senate where you need 60 votes to get anything done. And we also look at a recent Supreme Court ruling in which they basically have turned on the spigot on corporate spending in our elections. This is quite alien to the European way of doing democracy where, I can't think of another legislature in the world outside of California where you need a supermajority to get anything done. And certainly in European democracies, you need a majority. They pretty much ban corporate donations. They use things like public financing of campaigns and other methods like proportional representation to create multi-party democracy. And then fifth, in the area of what I call smart power foreign policy, which is compared to America's hard power foreign policy, Europe has really specialized in creating regional networks of investment, trade, and Marshall Plan-like aid to foster these peace and prosperity partnerships. So in these five areas are really where Europe is making its innovations that I think have a lot to offer the world and to the United States as we start really deliberating on how we're going to meet these two twin challenges of the 21st century. Now, as you may have noticed in my introduction, I'm the political reform director, so you might be thinking, like, how did political reform get off into so many broad areas? And it has to do with, in the late 1990s, I started traveling to Europe to study their political institutions. And in the process of doing that, started discovering a lot of other things about Europe that I hadn't known. In fact, as an American traveling to Europe, I had quite a few notions in my head that I had learned about Europe. And I'll bet a lot of you also have certain ideas in your head about when you think of Europe. So I'd like to invite all of you to just call out right now, when you think of Europe, what do you think of? I know I'm putting you on the spot, so take 10 seconds to think about it, and then just call them out. Say that out. Taxes. Health care. Pardon? Good transportation. What was that? Food. Okay, good food. Other thoughts? No guns. What was that? Vacation. How about mixed economy? When you think about the economy, is it, do you get the impression, is it strong? Is it weak? What do you... High unemployment. So anyway, we as Americans, we have a lot of ideas about Europe already. And I also had a lot of ideas. And I, in the process of learning, I discovered a lot of the ideas that I held about Europe were not particularly accurate. So, for example, the idea that Europe has a weak, and the word you see a lot in the U.S. media is sclerotic. They have a sclerotic economy. It's socialism. It's strangling in red tape, bureaucracy. You see this all the time in American media. And actually, what I discovered was that Europe actually has the largest economy in the world. It's nearly a third of the world's productive capacity, GDP, is produced by Europe. And Europe's economy is almost as large as the United States and China combined. Think about that. Europe has more Fortune 500 companies than the United States and China combined. Europe, there's an organization called the World Economic Forum that puts out a rating of national competitiveness for economies. And you hear that Europe's economy is not very competitive. Well, typically in the World Economic Forum's ratings on national economies, 7 out of 10 of the top slots are taken by European countries for national competition. In terms of economic growth, we hear that Europe is a low-growth economy. Depends on how you measure these things, but from 1998 to 2008, Europe actually had a faster GDP per capita growth rate than we had in the United States. So that was the 10 years leading up to the economic collapse, where Europe had a faster GDP per capita growth rate than we had in the United States. We hear about Europe being the land of high unemployment. Europe actually right now has lower unemployment than we have in the United States. In fact, Germany, during this economic crisis, their unemployment hasn't really even increased because of specific policies they have pursued to prevent unemployment from increasing, whereas in the United States, our unemployment has more than doubled during this economic crisis. Europe is the largest trading partner of both the United States and China. If you invested your money in the stock market in Europe up until 2008, when everything crashed, of course, if you invested your money in the stock market in Europe, on average, you made more money investing in the European stock markets than you did in the American stock market. Europe is the highest target of foreign direct investment by American businesses. If Europe's economy was such a mess, why would so many American businesses be investing in Europe? In fact, American businesses make 20 times the profit in Europe that they make investing in China. And small businesses. We think of the United States as being the land of small businesses. You hear that, you know, small businesses are the backbone of the American economy. Europe has more small businesses that produce two-thirds of the jobs in Europe compared to about half the jobs in the United States. So, you know, when it comes to these sorts of myths, the reality is actually quite different from what we sometimes read in the media. A couple of the myths that you hear, you know, for example, higher taxes. Well, it's true in one sense that Europeans pay higher taxes, but you have to look at what they're getting for those taxes. In return for those taxes, they're getting health care. They're getting a more generous retirement pension, government pension, than what we have with Social Security. They're getting things like much less expensive university education. In fact, in some countries, university education is still free. They have paid sick leave, paid parental leave, more vacations. You know, when your child is born, they receive something that's called a kiddie stipend, where you get, depending on the country, anywhere from $150 to $200 a month to pay for things like diapers and other things that you as a family need for your babies and for your family. They have a more affordable senior care. They're spending a lot more money on senior care than we have. And so what you start realizing is that for Americans to enjoy the things that Europeans get in exchange for their taxes, we pay a lot more out of pocket. So we're paying in the United States a lot more for escalating health care premiums, deductibles, co-payments. If you're an American who, you know, my sibling is, he's telling me he's going to be saving tens of thousands of dollars for his children to go to university education, whereas in Europe, they're getting that for free. Many students today in the United States, when they graduate from college, they have tens of thousands of dollars in loans. They're in debt when they graduate. You also have the average American is paying about, if you have children, about $12,000 per year for child care for two children. In Europe, they're paying, you know, $1,500 to $2,000 per year for child care. So you, in order to really figure out who's really paying more, it doesn't make any sense to not include all these out-of-pocket payments. The only way you could somehow exclude that is if you say, well, and some do say this, that, well, that's discretionary. You don't have to have child care. You don't have to have health care. You don't have to go to a university education. You decide whether you want to pay for that. In the United States, you get to decide for yourself whether you want to make those payments. Well, on one hand, that might be true. But in fact, in this increasingly competitive, multipolar world that we live in this age of increasing economic insecurity, I would argue that many of those things are no longer discretionary. For your family and for your lives, you need to have those sorts of supports, or else you're going to have a very difficult time in this world. So that's why when you look at things like, you know, the Forbes magazine puts out what they call their tax misery index every year. And so you see the European countries up there really high in the Forbes tax misery index because all they look at is really is income tax and sales tax, or VAT, as it's called in Europe. And then you see the United States down there happy as a clam around Malaysia and Indonesia because we're not paying that much in tax. We're just paying a whole lot more out of pocket, and they don't bother keeping track of that. Another way we're paying a lot more, it's kind of a hidden tax. The federal government gives a tax write-off to businesses for providing health care to their employees. It's a $300 billion a year tax write-off. It's $1,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States, many of whom don't have health care. So you have people that don't have health care are actually paying through their taxes to subsidize people who do have health care. It's a hidden tax, and yet that is not included in figuring out who's paying more in taxes. So there's lots of ways to calculate these things, and really when you add it all up and you do the balance sheet, what you discover is that Americans are paying out just as much as Europeans. We're just not getting anywhere as near as much for our money. That's really what it's about. And then also you hear a lot that another myth that Americans have a higher standard of living than Europeans. Well, let's look at that just for a moment. In the United States, we have 14% of Americans who are living below the poverty line, about 40 million people. In France, 6% live below the poverty line. In Britain, 8%. In Germany, Belgium, Switzerland, Sweden, 5% or less. 20% of American children are living below the poverty line. 23% of American seniors living below the poverty line. It's the highest number by far in the Western world, except for Russia and Mexico. We're 29th in infant mortality. We used to be, in 1960, the U.S. was ranked 12th in infant mortality, so we're going backwards. 37th in health care. France is ranked first. The wealthiest 10% of Americans own 70% of the nation's wealth, compared to Germany, where the wealthiest 10% own 44% of the nation's wealth. The Wall Street Journal had an article a few years ago showing that economic mobility is now greater in old Europe than it is in the United States. And some analysts have said, you know, if you didn't know anything about the United States but these kind of social and health indicators, you'd think we were a developing country. So where does this idea come from that we have a higher standard of living? It's because they use other measurements to figure these things out. So, for example, average income is one measurement they use, where they take everyone's income and they pool it all together and then they come up with an average number. Well, the problem with using average income, it suffers from what I call the Bill Gates paradox. Bill Gates walks into a bar and everyone's average income in the bar goes up by about $1 billion apiece, but they don't have a dime more in their pocket. Average income and some of the other measurements they use don't tell you anything about the distribution of that income. And what Europe has figured out is, you know, living in the 21st century, in this age of globalized capitalism, is not just about how much raw income you have in your pocket. It's about what kind of supports do you have for you and your family in this 21st century. And so really, when you step back and you look at the big picture, Europe has created what I call the book social capitalism, and I compare it to the American version of what I call Wall Street capitalism, where social capitalism is about how do you take the ability of capitalism to create wealth. And there's no question that capitalism is the greatest wealth creator that humans have ever invented. But there's an outstanding question there. What do you do with that wealth? Who gets the wealth? Whose pockets does it go into? And Europe has figured out how to harness the capitalist engine in a way to take that wealth and create a more broadly shared prosperity. And they do that not just by income, but by creating these support networks for families and individuals, things like healthcare, pensions, paid sick leave, paid parental leave, and other things that I mentioned earlier. This is a welfare. I mean, we, you know, in the United States, sometimes you see, well, Europe is a welfare state. It's a nanny state, and it's used derogatorily. In the book, I call it workfare, because this isn't about people kicking back and being on the dole. This is about how do you have supports for families and individuals so they can remain healthy and productive. That's what the European workfare system is about, and that's what the social capitalism is about. It's about harnessing that economic engine in a way that creates this more broadly shared prosperity, and then plowing that, instead of into the military machines that they had been for centuries, plowing that into supporting families and individuals, and doing that all in a way that's as environmentally sustainable as possible. Now, the European economy, the social capital, has a few other features that I think is worth pointing out for Americans, especially as we contemplate how do we make our economy work better than what it has in the last couple of years. One is they still have a fairly vibrant manufacturing and export sector, particularly countries like Germany and France, whereas the United States, starting with the Reagan era, we began de-emphasizing manufacturing and more greatly emphasizing the financial industry. So a much greater percentage of our GDP as well as corporate profits now comes from the financial industry, or well, it did until the collapse, compared to the manufacturing sector. And the manufacturing jobs have mostly gone offshore, and some of them have been taken up by countries like China, but also by countries like Germany and France, who have conscious policies to encourage the manufacturing sector. And in fact, there was a famous interview by former Prime Minister Tony Blair of German Chancellor Angela Merkel. And Angela Merkel, I think, is an amazing political figure. First female chancellor in Germany's history. She's the conservative in Germany, and yet she can talk very eloquently about things like social Europe and the importance of having things like social capitalism in a way that you even can't get Democrats to talk about today. And so anyway, Tony Blair was interviewing Angela Merkel. He said, you know, How does Germany do it? It's a country of only 80 million people. It's not that big. And yet you're the largest exporter in the world. How do you do it? And she looked at him and sort of deadpanned and said, "We still make things, Mr. Blair." It's not that complicated. And, of course, Britain was another country that, like under Margaret Thatcher, like under the United States under Ronald Reagan, much more ramped up their financial industry and now is paying the price compared to their manufacturing sector. So manufacturing is still important in many countries in Europe, and they've created an interesting east-west dynamic where a lot of the high-end manufacturing is done in Western Europe and a lot of the lower-end manufacturing assembly line work is now done in Central and Eastern Europe. The other important aspect that I mentioned earlier is that Europe has introduced into their economy a degree of economic democracy and also what is called, you hear the word used a lot in Europe, called consultation between workers and owners. And the way they've done this is with some really marvelous institutions. One is called codetermination. How many people here have heard of codetermination? I'm kind of curious. Just a few hands in the audience. And that's amazing to me that, you know, Americans don't know more about this. With codetermination, so for example, in Germany, we'll use them as the example, the major corporations, so BMW, Daimler, Siemens, they all have a board of directors like American corporations have, but 50% of the members of that board of directors are elected by the workers. Isn't that amazing to think that a major economy like Germany would allow 50% of the board of directors of the major corporations to be elected by the workers. In Sweden, a third of the board members are elected by the workers. You know, it would be as if we had a law telling Walmart, you must allow your workers to elect 50% of your board members. Imagine the impact that would make on Walmart in terms of its treatment of workers and even its conduct around the world and its supply chains and the many ways that Walmart uses to manipulate its economic power and influence. So you have this co-determination, supervisory boards, 50% being elected by the workers. And what this does is it doesn't mean that the management can't steer the company the way it wants to. It just means that they have to confer much more extensively with workers, their workers, than American corporations have to do. And so, of course, the knock of this would be, well, this is going to make Europe not competitive. It's going to hurt their economy. It's going to hurt their businesses. But if that's the case, then how is it that Europe has more Fortune 500 companies than we do? Why is it that Germany has major corporations that are leaders in their field in the global economy? How is it that Europe has such a robust economy if these sorts of structures truly are a drag on your economy? And the truth is that they haven't been a drag on the economy. In fact, there have been a number of studies asking the heads of corporations, what do you think of this co-determination? And a very high percentage of them said, you know, yeah, it's kind of a pain. I won't lie to you. But in fact, it actually helps us out in certain ways because it really enhances communication between the top and bottom of our business. It really allows the employees to feel like they have a degree of buy-in, so it decreases tension. It really helps labor relations in many, many ways. Another institution they have is what's called works councils. At the job site level, at the shop floor level, the employees all elect a works council that has tremendous influence over certain decisions in the business about how they're going to be treated by the employer. If layoffs are going to come, they can have a lot of say over who gets laid off or maybe even finding another arrangement to prevent layoffs. And this is how Germany has avoided a huge increase in their unemployment rate like we've experienced here in the United States, because instead of laying off millions of their workers during this economic crisis, instead what they did was in negotiation with their works councils and their co-determination supervisory boards and what have you, they decided instead to have all their workers take off a little bit of time. So instead of working 100%, maybe they're working 90% or 80%. It's called short work, or in German, Kurzarbeit. But in the meantime, during the good times, they've been squirreling away some money so that if you're a worker who's going from 100% to 80%, you're still getting 90% of your pay. So by doing this, a number of other good things happen. One, you keep your workforce together as a business manager so that when the economy starts picking up again, you now have your team together, and you don't have the tensions that occur in workplaces that get ripped apart when some are laid off and some are not, and how that can not only rip apart a business but can rip apart a whole community. You don't have that going on. And it also means that by having everyone cut back a little bit, you actually have more people with more money in their pockets. Because what happens in an economic decline like we're in is this downward cycle where, you know, businesses lay off people. People, therefore, have less money, so they quit buying. Therefore, businesses quit producing. They have to lay off more people. You get in a downward cycle. But by doing something like short work, you intervene in that downward cycle in a way that makes it not as severe. And so Germany's unemployment rate has, you know, stayed around 7.5%, whereas the United States, we've been at 10%. Now we're at 9.7%. So these methods work. They were discussed a little bit in the Obama administration. Robert Rubin was asked, why don't you do Kurzarbeit, short work, like Germany has done, instead of laying off all these people? His reply was, that's not American. So maybe it's time to reexamine what we consider American. I mean, I think in some ways the Europeans are much more pragmatic about these things and not so ideological. And the United States, even the Democrats, can sometimes be overly ideological on these sorts of things. A couple of other things I'll talk about just very quickly. Healthcare. Of course, we see the problems we're having in healthcare, the United States enacting healthcare. And when you look at European countries, you see that there's actually quite a bit of diversity in the types of healthcare systems, but there's two basic types. One is the single payer, sort of what's called socialized medicine in Britain, and they also use that in Sweden and a few other places. But actually more countries in Europe use a different type of healthcare entirely. It's what I call shared responsibility, where a certain amount is deducted from the employee's check, and then the employer kicks in a certain amount, an employer mandate, as it's sometimes called in the United States. If the individual can't kick it in themselves, the government will kick in their share. And so you have everybody sort of sharing in the paying of the premiums. But the other important part is that, for example, in Germany, they have over 200 insurance companies, private insurance companies, just like we have in the United States. But the difference is that in Germany, these insurance companies are nonprofits. They aren't for profits. And you see that in many other countries. France is another one, Belgium, Switzerland. So you have nonprofit insurance companies that form the backbone of your healthcare. And then every year or two, they get together and they negotiate fees for every service. And by doing that, you keep the costs down. And that's the problem in the United States, is all the plans that are being floated out there, they don't really have any means for keeping costs down. I'm talking about the ones that are being discussed in the Senate and the House. And because they don't want to take on the insurance companies. What you realize in looking at comparing the United States healthcare to European healthcare is that it's really about your values. Your healthcare system is going to reflect the values that you embrace into that system. And in Europe, their value is to create healthcare for people instead of profits. And as a result, the institutions they've created reflect that value. In the United States, the value we have is to create healthcare for profits instead of for people. And that's why it reflects the institutions that we have. And, you know, it's just simply a fact that the for-profit insurance companies have incentive to make your premiums as high as they possibly can be, because that puts more money in their pocket, and then to give you as little service as possible, because every service they give you takes money out of their pocket. That's the incentive in our for-profit healthcare system. And unless we address that value, we are never going to deal with the fact that the United States is paying 16 to 17% GDP of our GDP on healthcare, whereas other countries like Germany and France and others are paying 8, 9, some of them as high as 11%. They're paying a lot less money for their health care, and they're getting much better results besides. And until we really are deciding to deal with that aspect, it's going to be hard. I think we could have learned a lot from Europe in addressing our health care issues. And finally, I'll just talk about the many ways that Europe is addressing how do you do all this in an environmentally sustainable way. And there it's really kind of exciting, some of the things that they're doing. They're doing a lot with conservation technologies, the low-hanging fruit, as it's sometimes called, you know, just making sure that all your lights are the low-wattage CFLs now that they have, motion sensors, so that if no one's in a room, the lights go off, you know, and build downtown buildings. If you look at San Francisco at night, all the buildings are lit up. It doesn't have to be that way. You could have motion sensors so that those lights turn off completely or even just come down to a dimmer level. And you can go into European museums, and if no one's in the room, the lights are dim. And then when someone walks in, they go up bright. Escalators, they don't start until someone steps on the escalator. They're not going all the time. Until you step on the lip, it doesn't happen. It doesn't go. our appliances use huge amounts of standby power. Standby power is like you look at all of your appliances, and that today they all have a light on, even if you're not using them. My toaster has a light on that never shuts off. I mean, it's like they think I need to make toast in the dark or something. I mean, what is exactly the rationale behind this? You know, our stereos have lights on. They're always blinking, even when you're not playing them, right? This is called standby power. Huge amounts of power are used in standby power because it's in our homes, it's in our businesses, it's in our buildings. In Europe, they passed a regulation that said they had to reduce that standby power down to about 10% of what they were using before. So a lot of conservation, a lot of things like this go on. Their engines in their cars are half the size. In their homes, they're doing all these green designs way beyond insulation, hermetically sealed buildings where air can't go in and out unless you let it. And as the air goes out, it exchanges heat with the air coming in. And so you don't have to use more heat, really, to heat your building. They're doing things like they drill down into the ground where you reach a point where the air is the same temperature no matter the time of year. And then they can pull that air up into the building and either heat it or cool it depending on the season. And by doing that, you use a lot less energy. So they're way beyond LEED designs, as we sometimes call it in the United States. They're doing just very innovative things, you know, certain types of windows that are tinted. And so depending on the time of day, more light comes in or out, automatic shutters that can let light in or out so you don't have to use artificial lighting as much. And then in terms of renewable energies, they're doing some really eye-popping things. Of course, you know, you have the solar on the rooftops, but you have the huge solar arrays that can track the sun, so it's very efficient in bringing in all those photons. Huge windmill arrays, both on the land and offshore, creating serious amounts of megawattage. One of my favorites is called sea snakes. Off the coast of Portugal, you have these huge tubes, about 100 meters long, so about 300 feet long and about 20 feet in diameter. And they're floating in the ocean. They're connected to each other in grids. And in each sea snake, there's a piston that's just being driven up and down by the ocean waves. And then they can connect that to the shore, especially for some of the isolated coastal villages there. It's perfect for giving them energy that doesn't run out because the ocean never stops. And without having to, you know, lay power lines all across the land to reach those places. They're doing things like, imagine if you took a windmill and then sunk it beneath the ocean and drilled it into the floor. So now you have currents that are just ceaselessly turning these sea mills, I guess you'd call them. And you can make grids of these. And within, you know, not too many years, the city of London, a third of the households in the city of London will be powered by these sea mills off the coast of London. Transportation, high-speed trains. I was just back in Washington, D.C., you know, and there you have the Acela from New York to Washington, D.C. The Acela reaches high speed for about 14 miles of that trip. And they actually have the same engine, the French engine, that a lot of the French trains have, but they don't have the right tracks, so you can't go high speed. And, in France and Spain and other places, Germany, they have these high-speed trains that are amazing. I took a train through the tunnel from Brussels to London, and I remember being so excited, like, my God, this is one of the engineering marvels of the 20th century. And the thing that was most remarkable about going through the tunnel was how unremarkable it was. It was just like any other train ride. So, these are just, you know, some of the things. And I should say that in implementing all these things in a much more widespread fashion than we have here in the United States, Europe has what's called an ecological footprint, which is the amount of resources of the planet you're using. They have an ecological footprint that is half of that in the United States for the same standard of living. So it's doable. You can have a robust, vibrant economy. You can have a social capitalism that takes that wealth generated by that economy and harnesses it to create this more broadly shared prosperity. You can put more support around families and individuals, and you can do that all in a way that's as environmentally sustainable as Europe is doing. Europe is proof that you don't have to have these trade-offs between your economy and the environment, between businesses and communities, between families and the businesses in a community. Europe is in many – I mean, it's not to say that, you know, they don't have their problems. They don't have their ups and downs. The economy dips and goes up and down depending on what's going on with the global economy, obviously. And there's – three chapters in which I deal with things like immigration and low population growth in Europe. So if that's of interest, I can go into that, into the Q&A. But I think I'll just pause there, and we can open it up for Q&A and any comments you have. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
You are listening to It's Your World, a broadcast of the World Affairs Council. The program features Stephen Hill, director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation. I'm Jane Wales, your host. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in an exploration of global issues. To learn more about us, visit our website at www.itsyourworld.org or call us in San Francisco at 415-293-4600. That's 415-293-4600.
Thank you very much, Stephen Hill. And now we turn to your questions. Why don't we first just jump into sort of what the other side is, that is, what kind of reactions — your book is out just for a short time — but what kind of reactions have there been to your ideas around the country? What kind of criticisms have been made?
Well, a lot of the criticisms just I've noticed are, you see a repetition of the myths that I started out earlier, sort of rebutting, and you just see people just insisting, no, you're wrong, no, it's this, no, it's that. But one you see also is that Europe has been a free rider on America's military power. I hear that quite a lot. And certainly there's some truth to that, that in the post-World War II period, Europe was able to stop plowing all of its resources into the military machines that they had been, the countries had been for centuries, and start putting it into people because – you know, the Americans were giving Europe this protective shield from the Soviet Union. But it's interesting, you know, it was the conservative politicians of Europe that did this. It wasn't socialists, it wasn't even social democrats, but conservatives like Konrad Adenauer from Germany and Jean Monnet from France, Winston Churchill from Britain, who called for a new type of Europe, a United States of Europe, which is what Winston Churchill was one of the first people to coin that term. And they consciously wanted to get away from what their countries had been doing for so long in that regard. And in terms of Europe being a free rider today, you have to really ask ourselves, what are the military threats today? And is the response by either Europeans or the United States really an appropriate response to those military threats? Who is the enemy today? Is a question I would ask people to think about. Is it Iran? Well, Iran has a GDP that is the size of New Jersey's. Is it Afghanistan? Afghanistan has a GDP the size of Rhode Island's. Neither one of these are the Soviet Union in any way, shape, or form, and yet our military spending, our defense, hardly seems to have noticed. We build weapon systems today in the United States that are, you know, many military analysts will tell you are geared for fighting World War II. They're not geared for the current security threats. So why are we still building them? Well, because they're being built in some Congress member's district, and it's a jobs program. And that's what we as Americans really have to face, is that there is a trade-off, guns versus butter. And a Republican president by the name of Dwight Eisenhower warned us about this in the 1950s. And at this point, I think Europe has made a different calculation about what their security needs are. Which is interesting, because they're closer to Iran and Afghanistan than we are, but somehow they don't seem to feel as threatened by that as we do. I think that they have more tried to create these new techniques of using peace and prosperity partnerships, aid, trade, and investment, in order to foster this kind of regional peace and prosperity. If you compare Europe's foreign policy, for example, to Turkey, and you come to ours in Iraq or even Afghanistan, let's compare the differences. There wasn't that long ago that Turkey was a military dictatorship, had a human rights record on the order of Saddam's Iraq. And then under the incentives of Turkey wanting to become part of the European Union, which it's in line to become, it's kind of controversial, and it's going to take another 10 years for that to play out, but they're on the path. And there's a lot of carrots that are dangled in front of you if you're on the accession path to becoming part of the European Union. As a result of that, Turkey has changed. Turkey is now, for the most part, a modern, secular, Islamic democracy. It's actually possible to have an Islamic democracy. They still have problems, but you have the Kurds in Turkey now have their own radio stations with Kurdish language. Kurds get elected to the parliament in Turkey. You compare that to Iraq, where it's still, as far as I can tell, a sectarian tinderbox that may blow up at any time at us. And, you know, still you have the Sunnis and the Shiites blowing each other up. I think that it's maybe the United States needs to reexamine our approach to some of these areas and reexamine whether we need to plow so much money of our budget into defense. We spend more than the next 15 nations combined on military. Do we really need to do that much?
Let's accept the fact that the U.S. overspends, that the spending isn't very efficient. But isn't it the U.S. military investment that really allows Europe to put money into the environment, transportation, the arts, et cetera? And how would Europe have responded to 9/11, to Osama bin Laden? Where's the lift capacity, for example?
Couple things to know about Europe. Europe has the second, if you aggregate the different countries' defense budgets, they have the second largest defense budget in the world. It's never, nowhere near as much as the United States, but it's larger than anyone. It's even larger than China's, though there's some controversy about how much China really spends and whether they everybody, you know, you really know how much they're spending. They have two nuclear powers, France and Britain. They have tanks. They have helicopters. They have a lot of the modern helicopters. They have more soldiers in uniform than we have in the United States. So this is not just some, you know, weak military power. They just have a different calculation about what is in their security interests. And who knows how they would have handled Osama bin Laden. We don't. It's hard to reverse that wheel because we are where we are. We're still in the middle of the perpetual Osama bin Laden chase. And maybe they would have approached it differently. Certainly, Europe wasn't prepared to do anything in Bosnia in the early 90s. At that point, Europe, you have to also recognize that the European Union only began really as a European Union in the early 1990s. Before that, there had been attempts to bring Western Europe together, and they had many treaties since the 1950s. So it's been a slow period for Europe of coming together. But the European Union itself was founded in the early 1990s as a result of the Maastricht Treaty. And then it didn't reach its full size now of 27 nations, 500 million people, until 2004, when they added a bunch of nations from Eastern and Central Europe. So this is an entity still in formation. You know, it's instructive to remember that the United States, it took about 80 years for the United States, from our first government in 1790 till after the Civil War, for the United States to cease being a collection of regions and really be a nation. And by that measure, Europe is maybe on track. It's hard to really know what it's going to turn into, but it's certainly is heading in the right direction.
You offered to talk about aging and declining population. How do you think these will affect Europe's strength in healthcare and the economy and so on?
Well, the one of the criticisms of Europe is that they're not producing enough children. And this is particularly leveled at certain countries, namely Germany, Italy, and Spain, and because other countries like France, Ireland, Britain, and the Scandinavian countries are at or near what they call replacement level. Each woman has to produce a certain number of children on average in order to replace your population, or you start declining in population. And the feeling is that it's not just a problem in terms of declining population of your country, but there's something called the dependency ratio. How many workers does each generation have to support the people who aren't working, either seniors or children or unemployed or people who are disabled? If your dependency ratio is too low, if you don't have enough workers, that you won't be able to afford the social benefits that Europe gives and that the United States gives to some degree. So this is an area where everyone's got their crystal ball out with all sorts of predictions. And to be honest, I don't know the answer. No one does. But what you can see is that there are programs going on in order to try and boost childbirth, where they actually are paying more money for women to have children in certain countries. Whether this will be effective or not, it's hard to say. But there is research that indicates that if women don't have to choose between being a stay-at-home mom or having a career, they're more likely to have children. If you make them choose between one or the other, more women today will choose a career, and that will decrease your birth rate. And so the feeling is that that Europe has to do a few things in order to have its population not decline too much. One is it has to allow a certain amount of immigration, and that creates other tensions that we can talk about if that's of interest. Two, it has to get more women in the workforce, and particularly certain countries like Italy, Spain, and Germany, especially Italy and Spain, actually have a lower percentage of women in the workforce than a lot of the other European countries. And it's sort of interesting historically; those were all are all formerly fascist countries, And the fascists had a cult around motherhood that would discourage women from working, and it discouraged them to be mothers and produce the heirs of the nation, so to speak. So that those mentalities are still there to some degree, but they're starting to overcome them. I mean, Germany actually lagged behind France and other countries in the number of child care centers, for example. Now they've elected indirectly elected a chancellor, a woman chancellor, and she has tripled the number of child centers in Germany. The other things that they need to do is Europe has been known as a place where its workers are very productive. The productivity level is quite high. If they keep their productivity level high, that allows you to produce more with fewer workers. And so by doing these sorts of things, some people feel Europe is going to be fine. Others say, no, they're still going to have a problem. I don't know. Everyone's got their crystal ball. I invite you to share your viewpoints as well.
You touched on immigration. Isn't immigration a major source of problems in Europe today? Aren't they having tremendous problems with ethnic minorities and handling them poorly?
Immigration is definitely another challenge for Europe. And going forward, it's going to be something that they are going to have to deal with better than they have in the past. But I see positive signs there. I mean, a few things to know about the immigration issue. When they talk about immigration, a lot of times they're talking about Islamic immigration and the clash between Islam and the West, and that Europe has been this, white Christian place for over 1,000 years, and so there's a clash there and they don't fit and all these sorts of things. One, the number of Islamic immigrants in Europe is about 3%. It's not very high. Some countries are higher. France, for example, which is a country you hear about raising this in this issue quite a lot, France has more immigrants from Portugal than from North Africa. And most of those immigrants that come from Islamic countries, they're not coming to create jihad. They're coming to get their version of a middle class life. You have Muslim immigrants from all sorts of countries in North Africa and the Middle East. And instructively, the only language they can communicate in is French. The only language in Germany that the Muslim immigrants can communicate in is German, because they're from different parts of the world. And so what I'm suggesting is that there's a lot of hype around this. Certainly there is issues. The conclusion I came to in the book is that Europe doesn't have an immigration problem because it needs a certain amount of immigration. It has an integration problem. And that's a subtle but significant difference, because, if you think about some of you may remember the French youth that burned 10,000 cars a few years ago, were rioting in the streets. None of them were immigrants. They all had been born in France. None of them were particularly religious. They might come from Islamic backgrounds, but they weren't particularly religious. They were upset about the segregation that they've experienced, not necessarily as Islamic faith people, but for jobs, for getting ahead, these sorts of things. And in that area, there's no question that Europe has a problem. The other thing to realize, though, is that Europe has been going about this a lot for a lot less time than we have in the United States. It's just the case that any country, you have a majority and you have a minority. And the majority tends to marginalize the minority and ignore that minority until that minority becomes numerically large enough that they can't be ignored anymore. That certainly has happened in the United States. And then once that minority becomes large enough, a reaction arises to say, get rid of this minority, get them out of the country. Only to discover that the minority at that point is too numerous to do that to for any self-respecting democracy. You can't just start deporting mass amounts of people. So, and also that minority fills a lot of important jobs in the economy. So a parallel movement arises to then start the integration process. And that's where Europe is, where it started the integration process. At this point, tons of programs are being set up. Tens of billions of euros are being spent on bilingual programs, on language radio stations in many different languages, on fostering economic programs in different neighborhoods and communities. But this is certainly a work in progress. It's another area where everyone's got their crystal ball out trying to predict what the future is going to be. And I can't really stand here and tell you what it's going to be. I think Europe knows it has a problem. It's identified the problem, and it's starting to put into place programs to make this work better. We'll see how it works out.
You spoke favorably about the governance structures in Europe. One of the members of the audience asks, aren't the political institutions in Europe weak and lacking in checks and balances?
Well, you have to distinguish the political institutions at the national level of each country, as well as at the European Union level. At the national level, I would argue that their political institutions are actually much better than we have in the United States. And they actually are better at giving representation. More women get elected in their legislatures, and there's all sorts of whole body of research out there about the presence of women in your legislature makes a qualitative as well as quantitative difference in the types of bills that are passed and introduced. You have countries like Sweden and others where, you know, 40-45% of the legislators are women. And here in the United States, how many women in the United States House of Representatives? Anybody know?
About 17%.
17%, exactly. So as well as young people getting elected. In Sweden, a 19-year-old got elected. In Germany, a 19-year-old got elected, both from the Green Party. In Denmark, a 23-year-old got elected from the Conservative Party. And it's because the types of methods they use where you have lists of candidates. And so as a party, you have incentive to diversify your list along racial lines, gender lines, age lines in order to pull people out. And so a lot more voters in the European political systems, they can look out there in the political landscape, and there's a range of parties, multi-party democracy. They can see a party that more mirrors who they are and where they're coming from, and vote for a party and actually see that party win. Even if you get 10% of the vote as a party, you're going to get 10% of the seats in the European systems. Here in the United States, you get 10%, you get nothing. And so as a result, in the United States, the choice you have in most of our districts, you know, we elect one district representative at a time. We can tell you who's going to win 90% of those seats right now in the upcoming November election. The choice for you as a voter, because you're living either in a solidly Democratic district or a solidly Republican district in most cases, is to ratify the candidate of the party that dominates your district. That's the choice we have in our elections in the United States. Well, in Europe, they have a much broader array of choices, and as a result of that, you see much higher voter turnout, sometimes twice as high as what we have in the United States. So I would, and they also have public financing of campaigns, free media time for candidates and parties, so you have a more robust discussion of ideas because you're not so dependent on private money in order to get your ideas out there. And they have universal voter registration. Everybody is registered to vote. You don't have to, you know, fill out these little cards like you have to do in the United States. And around each election time, you have this struggle going on where one side tries to get their voters on and get the other side off. That's what goes on in the United States. In European countries, 100% universal voter registration. If you have a pulse and you breathe, you are registered to vote. And that's how we ought to do it in the United States. So at the EU level, now you have a whole other level of institutions where there's been problems with accountability. And it's a whole long discussion that I don't know if we have time to go into. But they just recently adopted a new treaty called the Lisbon Treaty that's supposed to clarify some of these things. We'll see if it does.
And now it's time for the final question. You have pointed out a number of policies where you feel that the U.S. should consider following Europe. So a couple of people in the audience have asked the question, how can we influence the U.S. policymaking and the media to change its opinion of the European model? And how do we turn your proposals into part of a serious debate?
Well, that's in 2 minutes. you know, I think Americans have a lot of strongly held views about Europe, obviously, but also about themselves and about our country. And I think part of it is about showing that we don't have to be so locked into our ways. I mean, in many ways, we're much more ideological than Europe. Europe is more pragmatic than we are. Europe, for example, in the late 90s, when their businesses were in some ways too bureaucratic and there was not enough labor flexibility, as it's called, they made changes. You know, they didn't say, oh, we're socialist Europe and we can never make these changes. And of course, these changes were easy. Some people fought them. But by and large, they were able to make changes, adjust their economy in a way that made their economies more competitive, but also preserved what's called social Europe. Whereas in the U.S., we seem to be really stuck to the flypaper of old ideas. We seem to think that somehow we're the best, and what we've done is what the rest of the world wants to do, and it really isn't, and that we have to somehow keep doing things the way we've always done them. I debated someone from the Hudson Institute not that long ago about all this, and that's a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C. And I swear she had the same talking points that the conservatives have had since before the economic crash. And they're just, you know, big government is bad. Get regulation out. People have to be self-reliant. I mean, you know, the same sorts of things. And I think we just have to keep challenging these views that having support for families and individuals isn't about big government. It's not about people on the dole. It's about how do we help people pursue opportunity. That's what this country is supposed to be about, is opportunity, right? Well, that's what this is about. It's about how do we help people pursue their own life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That's what Europe has come up with, a different way of doing this. And so I just think we have to keep pecking away at it. We have to, challenge people in our letters to the editor, on the internet, on talk radio, challenge our elected officials. I mean, if some of you may know election officials, go and ask them to introduce a bill for co-determination. It just takes a law, you know. In fact, interestingly, I know we're running out of time, but co-determination came after World War II, and the American Allied powers, including the Americans, were actually very encouraging of Germany doing this sort of thing because they were very interested decentralizing German industrialist power that had supported the Nazis. And so they saw it as a good thing that Germany wanted to start doing this kind of co-determination where, you know, boards of directors would be elected by workers and such, because it would drain power from the powerful German industrialists who had supported the Nazis. And so in the book, one of the points I make is that, you know, the United States, we punished Germany by giving them economic democracy. Well, we can do the same thing here. We can get bills introduced for things like economic democracy, consultation, co-determination. We can change our electoral system to things like proportional representation. We can get public financing of campaigns. We can send a message to Congress that we don't think you should have to have 60 votes in the Senate to get something done, that it should be a simple majority. That's what democracy is about. These things are all doable, and all of us can do it. And all of you can play a role just in talking about these things. Get a copy of the book so you can learn about these things and start telling the people and share your copy with other people so they can learn about it. I mean, you know.
And on that note, we are
one
out
step
of time.
At a time. And there's a website for the book, europespromise.org, for anyone who wants to check out the book, europespromise.org. Thank you.
On behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and Books, Inc., I'd like to thank Stephen Hill for providing us with his thoughts and insights. Many thanks to the audience as well for your outstanding questions. Mr. Hill has agreed to stay a while and sign copies of his book, Europe's Promise, on stage. I encourage all of you to take advantage of this opportunity. Thanks very much. Good night.
You've been listening to It's Your World, a broadcast of the World Affairs Council. The program featured Stephen Hill, director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in an exploration of global issues. To learn more about us, visit our website at www.itsyourworld.org or call us in San Francisco at 415-293-4600. That's 415-293-4600. It's Your World is made possible weekly by the generous support of the Chevron Corporation. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of KQED's Producer Circle. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. It's Your World is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.